Okay, let's go now into the psalm. I think I can move fairly rapidly through the psalm. Fools say in their hearts, there is no God. Comically, unfairly, but it still makes a point. Some people take these words out of context, there is no God, and say, it's like fundamentalism, if you're not careful, taking texts out of context. Someone could say, oh, well, the psalm says there is no God. Well, it does too. You can't say it doesn't. There it is. And then someone says, but hang on. If you read the whole sentence, it says, fools say there is no God. And that's blunt and pretty, but it's not a bad little thing, you can hardly miss it, to say that every time you take a text out of the scriptures, you've got to look at the context, the whole context, the whole gospel, and then the whole movement of the where it's come from. It's not an isolated little word. The whole of the scriptures are inspired, but if you take a flower out of a flower arrangement and put it in a little vase on its own, it may not be very inspired. Whereas in the flower arrangement, it's really, you say, wow, isn't that a wonderful arrangement? But the little twig on its own doesn't catch your attention. So that scripture has to always, it's a vast study, as you know. Well, that statement, there is no God, there's Psalm 10, says it's Psalm 94, Job, not saying how foolish people are to say it. It recurs throughout the scriptures. Then the psalm goes on, verse 2, they are corrupt. They perpetrate dreadful deeds. There's no one who does good, says the psalmist. God looks down from heaven on Adam's descendants to see if there's a wise person anywhere, one who seeks after God. You don't have God, but you're still pointing and seeking. They've all gone astray, he says. They're all depraved. There's no one who does good. No, not one. I think when he finished writing that, his wife came into the room and said, look, Bill, take it easy. You're overstating it a bit, like, you know, go and have a holiday or take the kids for a walk or something, or kick the dog, but do something, because it's a bit grim, isn't it? He's looking at, but well, you might have felt like that sometimes. Anyhow, that's what he's saying. He's not the only one to have talked like that. Maybe you have at times too. Here's Genesis chapter 6. Yahweh saw that the wickedness of humankind was great on the earth. This is leading up to the flood, eh? And it's violence. Read Genesis carefully. The sin of the book of Genesis is violence throughout. And that's some truth and violent, untruth and violence to have a very top billing in the biblical tradition, and good O. And every inclination of their thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. And Yahweh was sorry that he'd made humankind on the earth. It grieved him to the heart. Quaint, simple, lovely. Philosophically, doesn't hold together too well. But here's God saying, oh God, I made a terrific... Oh, he couldn't say, oh God, could he? But anyhow, I've made a terrible error in creating human beings. Look at them. So he decides he better get rid of the lot. And let's say he has a flood. You know the story. Unfortunately for all that, there was one good person. It's the power of one, Noah. You could be one Noah if you want to. Anyone can be Noah. So don't historicize it. But here is an interesting thing. This is Paul's letter to the Romans. And it's chapter 3, verse 10 to 17. And Paul is arguing this is a brilliant letter. Such a logical letter. Wonderful stuff. Because most of Paul's letters are just answering questions and bits and pieces. But this letter is not answering any questions. It's putting out his gospel. It's very powerful, and it's no accident that it gets so much attention. I actually don't think it's his most beautiful letter, because he's still struggling and putting out his gospel against people who oppose it. If I'm right, and I reckon I am, but anyhow, if he wrote Ephesians, I think that is his most beautiful letter, because he's not fighting anybody. He's about to leave the East, and he's saying what he sees the gospel as, free of any polemic, argument, or he just says it, and it's just wonderful stuff. Too wonderful not to be Paul's, I think. Anyway, here he is in Romans, concluding the first part, where he's talking to Jews and saying, look, stop saying the Gentiles have got all these problems. You've got them too. Look at your lives. We're all sinning. We're all got a We all need redemption. We all need love, and we all need meaning. And this is what he says. The first two, three verses are a direct quote from our psalm. There's no one who's righteous, not even one. There's no one who has understanding. There's no one who seeks God. All have turned aside. Together they become worthless. There's no one who shows kindness. No, not even one. And then Paul goes on from there, again quoting Psalm 5, Psalm 140, Psalm 10, Isaiah 59 and Psalm 36. He gathers together the texts that he's... And look, I'll finish, Paul. Their throats are open graves. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of vipers is under their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery are in their paths, and the way of peace they haven't known. There's no fear of God before their eyes. Paul is making a point, but he's also piling up Jewish evidence for it, because he's writing to Jews, going to say, look at you, look, look. It's not just me saying this, it's being said by the prophets and the psalmists. So have a good look at yourself and realize how much you need what Jesus is offering you. And so you need to change. You need to step out from where you've been and embrace, as Paul had to do. Verse 4, those evildoers, do they know nothing? And the next line will be just wonderful. But do they know nothing? Perhaps if we jump to the next line. They devour, this is the injustice, they devour my people as if they're eating bread, and they do not call upon God. They're their own last thing. They don't think of opening themselves to the mystery, because if they did, their behaviour would be so different. And they're devouring my people as if they were eating bread. Ooh, that's pretty powerful. And if you don't think it's powerful, look at Micah chapter 3, verse 2 and 3. Micah, one of the early prophets, contemporary with Isaiah. So what are we talking about, 700s BC? You who hate the good and love the evil, who tear the skin off my people and the flesh off their bones, who eat the flesh of my people, flay their skin off them, break their bones in pieces, chop them up like meat in a kettle, like fish flesh in a cauldron. Obviously metaphorical, but that's what you're doing to the poor and the broken. Well then, says our psalmist, verse 5, and this is the conclusion of our psalm, they shall be in great terror, in terror such as not been before. For God will scatter the bones of the ungodly. They will be put to shame, for God has rejected them, says the psalmist. And when Jesus was a little boy and Joseph was praying Psalm 53, Jesus snuggled up to him and said, Daddy, do you think that's true? And Joseph said, look, darling, I don't really, but it's in the psalm, and let's not get too involved in too much philosophy. Talk to your mother. So Jesus went out and had a chat with Mary, and she consoled him. And then as Jesus got a bit older, he realized it was actually wrong. But God doesn't reject anybody. We reject God. We say, God, why have you abandoned me? And God says, why have you abandoned me? It's self-inflicted what we do. God is constantly loving, and Jesus showed that beautifully in his life. The church teaches it, doesn't always practice it, because I'm in the church, you're in the church, and we're not perfect. In fact, we're far from it often. And the less humble we are, the more blundering we do, the more harm we do. But that's what the psalmist said. And you have to read that with care, don't you? Because that could reinforce the idea that God will ultimately reject people. God will... I've heard it when I was a child in here. God will send you to hell. Is that news to anybody? It's heresy. But anyhow, it's said. God doesn't send anyone anywhere. We stubbornly, determinedly, if we do, I don't know that anyone's in hell, neither do you. And by faith, we have to believe there are people in heaven. That's what we call saints. That's what that's all about. There is no statement in our faith anywhere, nor will there ever be, that there's anyone in hell. But that it's possible to stubbornly reject God and suffer the consequences forever is said by Jesus, and it's said by the church right through. So it's a warning to us to take our life seriously. Oh, he concludes, that deliverance for Israel would come from Zion. When God restores the fortunes of his people. So the fortunes of his people have obviously been obliterated somehow in Samaria or Jerusalem. Jacob will rejoice. Not now, we're not, but we will. And Israel will be glad.